Okay, so we have to finish the three things the Rav is explaining, what the prophetic and prayer community have in common. Very important, fundamental idea in this work of Lonely Man of Faith. The whole book is basically established on the covenantal community, which is Adam, the world of Adam 2. And the covenantal community includes two models, two parts to the covenantal community. What does the covenantal community include? Prophecy and prayer. And the Rav is one of the Rav's most important theses in this book and Bechlal, that the Rav is very big in explaining how prophecy and prayer are two sides of the same coin, and that coin is called covenantal community. So the first thing that he's been explaining that we spent a couple of weeks on because it's so important is what's the first thing that prophecy and prayer have in common? Encounter between God and man. Both prophecy and prayer are conversation, encounter, dialogue, with all the different explanations of what we explained that means. But prayer and prophecy, prayer is not praising God, and prophecy is not talking about God. Although we have parts of our tefillah service where we talk about God, Psukei Dezimra, and although there were prophets that spoke about God, like Tehillim, like many chapters of Job and Isaiah, whatever, but the ultimate prayer and prophecy will make it the covenantal community is that it's dialogue, it's confrontation, it's encounter. And therefore the Rav, and this is what we spoke about for the past couple of weeks, the most important part of tefillah, of prayer, which we spoke about, that before we open our mouths, this is what we must, if we take anything out of the book Lonely Man of Faith, that's practical, that we use on a daily basis, is that before we open our mouth, every time we daven three times a day, at least for a couple of seconds to have in mind, know before whom one is standing. I'm talking to God. This is a conversation. This is a dialogue. This is an encounter. And that's why it's the second half of prophecy. And that's what we spend a long time explaining. And now we're going to finish this. And we're going to read today. There's a lot to read text. The way the Rav explains this more. And we're going to read today very soon one of my most famous sentences in the entire world. One of my most favorite sentences. When we'll get there, we're very close to it. What do you mean?
That's the sentence. How much can I
take? Oh. I guess if you're talking about rabbis, that's like a... L'chaim. This is pretty good. It's really good. Okay, sorry. Page 54, the bottom over here, bottom line, we're in the middle of the number one, I don't know, in your books, where by the sentence, in short, prayer and prophecy are two synonymous designations. Mm-hmm. Right? The last thing we read is the very essence of prayer, the covenantal experience. Everyone sees it?
Bottom of page 35.
It's, you know where it is? You know, see where footnote yeah. one? Remember last yeah. week we finished footnote one? Right after footnote one. Okay? Yeah. It's good. Yeah, everyone sees where footnote one is? Right after that. Everyone with me? Okay, let's go. In short, yeah?
After footnote
well, not, no, it's the below, one, the one, right below it. The one, right after the one that tells you to go to that footnote. In other words, you know what I mean? Further on, it's much earlier in the chapter. Much earlier in the chapter. It's where the footnote one is in the text, sends you to footnote one. It's before two. Keep going. It's a very long chapter, so you got to... Do you see where there's the three and the two?
Three.
Yeah, so you got to go before two, or...
How do you start it? Where are you starting it?
With the footnote one. We left last week. We remember the footnote one with Reb Chaim.
Yeah, I'm saying
it. So it, see, oh, over there, where the footnote one is. Short. There it is. Right. Everyone have it? Everyone sees it in short? Mm-hmm. Says the Holy Rav, in short, prayer and prophecy are two synonymous designations of the covenantal God-man colloquy. Meaning, the essence is the being together with and talking to God. Yeah? Everyone with me? Indeed. The prayer community, now the Rav is now going to go on to say that this thesis of the Rav, that prayer and prophecy are two sides of the same coin, is best proved by the historical account of when the established organized prayer that so many of us love to hate, When did that historically, when did that prayer community come to being? That's what the Rav is going to say now, and that's going to prove his thesis. Indeed, the prayer community was born the very instant the prophetic community expired. When did the prophetic community expire? Historically. Bayis Sheni. When in Bayis Sheni?
At the beginning.
Towards the beginning, a couple of years after the Second Temple was built. We know that the Second Temple was built, there were still prophets around. And who were the ones that instituted, that essentially organized Judaism into an organized religion, transitioned from biblical to rabbinical Judaism? The men of the Great Assembly, Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, the 120 of the greatest tzaddikim of the generation.
Well,
you could say that. And by the way, you should know, just if I'm, because we're going to speak about the men of the Great Assembly, the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah a lot. You ever heard of Reb Reuven Margolius?
Sure.
What do you know about him?
Sanhedrin.
He wrote a lot about it. He has a Sefer Margolius Sayyam and Sanhedrin.
Shari
Zohar. Nitzutze Zohar.
Malachi
Elyon. Do you know about him historically?
Sure. He was a starker
Zionist. He was a bookseller, but he was a businessman. Yeah. You know, he came from Munkach. He came from Munkach Chassidim. It's interesting because he became such a Zionist. But anyway, he's a huge Talmud Chacham. I mean, he wrote Svarim. That today, every idiot puts out a Sefer because you just have, you know, Google, you have Hatek Hadbek with Oitzar Chochma, you know, copy and paste, right? But he put out Svarim before there was such a thing as Google, which, like, you see, had like a computer. Like Rav Avad Yosef, the same type of thing, but he was also very ahead of his time. So anyway, he has a whole Sefer, I forgot what it's called, where he speaks about the history. I think it's called Yisoy Tersha Bal Peh, something like that. I forgot the exact title. But one of the things he speaks about when he speaks about our Mesorah, which is so important. Ever wonder why there were 120 men in the Great Assembly? Sanhedrin is supposed to be 71. How'd they get 120 all of a sudden? And it was the only time in history. Mitamol, all of a sudden you have 120 people sitting, hanging out over there. So he actually explains a fascinating thing, which I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but basically he says that the 71 Sanhedrin were smuchim ish mipi ish from Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara speaks about, the Mesorah speaks about that from Moses until the destruction of the first temple, we had a clear Mesorah. The 71 Sanhedrin, there was always 71, and there was a Reish Bezdin, always. If you look at the Maimonides and Mishnah Torah, he clearly delineates the 40 generations from Moshe to Rabbi Yudah Nasi, and then to Rav Ashi, to the Gemara. We have a clear delineation. There was no like newcomers on the scene, new kids on the block. So he said there was only one time in our history where the Sanhedrin had a stop, and that was the Babylonian exile. I mean, and then, of course, after the second destruction. So he says, you always had 71 from the time of Moses, and whenever one of them died or whatever happened, you would just add another one. But the only time there was no Sanhedrin was in the Babylonian exile. So now, once you had over here, you didn't have the 71 anymore, how are you going to decide who gets to be the 71? So that's why at that time, he explains based on a lot of Pupulim, why they brought together all, that's what it means, Knesset HaGdolah. That's what the words mean, the men of the Great Assembly. You never stop to think about it. What do you mean Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly? The Great Assembly, because that was the time that they essentially assembled after the Babylonian exile, when they built the Second Temple, when they assembled all those great rabbis and leaders and prophets that were still around, that returned to Israel at that time. Because not everyone did, as we know, right? So that's why they didn't stick to the 71 model. They had 120. And he explains that they waited until they went down to 71. They didn't replace anyone until those people died out. And then they continued to stick to the 71 number.
But 120, I mean, it's off topic, but that was not one generation. That spent 300 years, the 120 people.
What do you mean?
Sure. Anshe Knesset HaGdolah started by Ezra.
Right.
And it went all the way down to Alexander's time, Alexander the Great's time, after which the Sanhedrin...
I don't think that's not true.
Sure.
No. Shimon HaTzadik, how does Pirkei Avos begin? Haya?
Mishiyare
Anshe Knesset HaGdolah. He was one of those that survived from the original 120. But there weren't 120 around at the time of Alexander the Great, as far as
no,
I know.
No, I'm saying the 120 number was a compilation of all the people that were included in this great group over two, three, four, five generations.
As far as I understand, is that Ezra made Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, 120 people, and that Anshe Knesset HaGdolah was a one-time thing, that lasted for a couple, I don't know, however many decades, but then they died out, and as the Rebbe Reuven Margolis explains, is that until they came to 71, and then they just kept replacing the 71. So with the Mishnah, the way Pirkei Avos begins, that Shimon HaTzadik was Mashiach, you know what I'm talking about, Shimon HaTzadik, we're referring to when Alexander conquered Jerusalem, Shimon HaTzadik was the Kohen Gadol that went to greet him in the clothing of the high priest. So Pirkei Avos says he was, with a dream, he was Mashiach, he was those that remained from Nashik Nes HaGadolah. Now anyone, let's see, historically, when was Alexander the Great? How long after the Second Temple was built? Second Temple was built 400 BCE, right, correct?
So it was about 235 years afterwards.
235 years after, so how would Shimon HaTzadik still be alive? Still be alive? No, how could that be?
That's what I'm saying.
16. BCE? Can't what? Be. Second Beis HaMikdash stood for 430 years. It was destroyed in 70
right.
CE. Mm-hmm. So it was approximately 350.
And Alexander was approximately somewhere between 175 and 200 BCE.
So that would mean that Shimon HaTzadik was really very old. It was one of the last
That's
ones that were
I'm
there.
That's why I'm saying I contend that the 120 Mishiare means he was at the tail end of what was considered Anshei Knesset HaGdolah.
That's interesting. That would be against what Rav Magal. Okay, could be I'm wrong.
Weren't there 70 years between the destruction of the second and the building of the destruction of the first?
Right,
temple.
Yeah. So but the men, no, but the men of the Great Assembly were by the second temple.
So the destruction was 586 of the first.
Okay.
And, it, and what happened in five, what happened 7 years later? 516.
It can't be that it was...
Well, they were given... It's not. It's 70 years between the second Golos...
Until they were given
until
permission.
Until they were given permission to build the second Bias.
I thought they built it 70
no,
years later.
No,
586
they began. They got.
They
I think that's when Koresh, when Cyrus gave the proclamation
right.
that they
Nehemiah
can build.
And Ezra didn't come till a good 50 years later.
Why would it be called the Great Assembly if it was nothing more than 71?
I don't know. No, I, heard not, shear, okay. Okay. I heard a shear. I heard a shear on
it's
this.
It's an interesting. It's a very important historical
more
thing.
More interesting is how did they but pick the 120?
Meaning whoever that's what Rebbe Margolis says. Whoever
no,
was.
You mean 121? There was no hundred number. Some guy wasn't all in the...
Like insulted and like pissed off and like, no, and like, you know, started a new form of Judaism? No, I apparently, unless it wasn't successful. He was one of those...
I wasn't around.
Yeah, I know. Maybe Monty Python would have made a whole thing about it if there was someone like that. But not that I know of. I don't know.
So a question related to the text, right? The Rav is saying, as far as I understand, that prophecy and prayer are intrinsically linked because those are both methods by which we can
encounter
God, right? But historically, isn't it the case that I mean, my understanding is that institutionalized prayer was sort of a plan B, right?
Exactly. So that's Yaakov's asking a great question. The Rav is saying historically that prayer began after prophecy ended, but what do you mean? We spoke about many times that they prayed before, it wasn't, what did you say?
Institutionalized
prayer. So that's, look at the words the Rav used. The Rav is very careful in the words. Indeed, the prayer community. The prayer community means that we're all saying the same words. That's the var.
That we've been institutionalized.
Exactly.
We're
all institutionalized. Exactly. We're saying the same words. And we're gonna see, by the way, remember I told you that the Rav over here is learning three things where prayer and prophecy have in common? Remember? We're hopefully going to get to today. The second one is the fact that it's communal.
But the Rav would disagree that institutionalized prayer is a plan B. In other words, ideally, we would have had the Beis HaMikdash, and we would never have been so institutionalized.
No, the Rav might disagree.
Like,
he might say it is a plan B. Let's read. He is going to say that it's a plan B in some ways. Look, and that's my favorite sentence in the world. We'll get to it. Look, indeed, the prayer community was born the very instant the prophetic community expired. The prayer community, meaning that we're saying the same words. And when it did come into the spiritual world of the Jew of old, it did not supersede the prophetic community, but rather perpetuated it. Right? It didn't supersede it, but perpetuate. Does everyone know what the word supersede means? Yeah? Does everyone know the connotation in theology, in study of religion, that supersession always... That's right. Supersession, supersede, is a very, very heavy word, because it's a word that Christianity, essentially, their whole belief is based on the fact that these superseded Judaism. In other words, they don't dispute anything in our Tanakh. Mm-hmm. They just say that came a long time for a New Testament, right? So superseding is a very loaded word, and the Rav is using it bedafka. He's saying that our rabbinic Judaism, that everyone loves to say that rabbinic Judaism sucks and our biblical Judaism was awesome, so the Rav is disputing that, and he's saying no. When it came into the spiritual world of the Jew of old, it did not supersede the prophetic community, but rather perpetuated it. The whole point of rabbinic Judaism and the fact that we become institutionalized, and those there might be those that might disagree, at least emotionally, but what's supposed to be happening, as we've been discussing, is that it did not supersede it. It's not a new religion superseding the old one. It's perpetuating it. Prayer is the continuation of prophecy. That's an unbelievable thesis for the prayer is a continuation of prophecy. Think about every time you open your siddur, you're continuing prophecy. You're a continuation of the prophets of old. You're continuing it.
So it's not a plan.
And the fellowship of prayerful men, meaning when there's a minion, is ipso facto the fellowship of prophets. It's a crazy thing to think, right? We love romanticizing the B'nai HaNaviim, those times prophets, they would go together and they would try to prophesize. What's supposed to happen when we get together in Davin is that fellowship of prophets is now the fellowship of prayer. We're supposed to together be bringing God into the world. Imagine trying that in a Shabbos morning in a shul. Well, there are shuls that do that. But that feeling that we've come together to... You know what we always think? Imagine coming into your shul a Shabbos morning, especially now that I'm living in Tinek for a couple of months, having a special taiva to do this, you know, give a clap at 9 o'clock before the guy gets up and say, "Gentlemen, we have now come assembled together to worship the Lord. And we've come together as a group to transcend our mundane lives and enter a world of covenant and dialogue with God." You know what would happen? You'd probably be thrown and laughed right out the doors in most shuls, right? Because a lot of people don't think of it like that. You come to shul Shabbos morning because you got to go to shul Shabbos morning, right? But they're always saying that's what's supposed to happen. And if it's not supposed to be said, because unless you say a couple of l'chaims, but that's what's supposed to be felt. That's what they're always saying. The prayer fellowship of prayerful men is ipso facto the fellowship of prophets. The difference between prayer and prophecy is, as I've already mentioned, what's the difference between prayer and prophecy is related not to the substance of the dialogue. The dialogue is the same, but rather to the order in which it is conducted. Meaning?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's beautiful what the Rav is
supposed to say.
I'm
sorry to interrupt the regularly scheduled broadcast.
Right.
Yeah.
It's beautiful what the Rav is saying, and it's perhaps a intellectual pep talk for all of us who daven communally, or however you want to phrase it, but it makes no sense.
Why?
Because, at least from my understanding of nevuah, is, and let's say you want to take, however you define nevuah, but let's say you take it the way the Rambam takes it, you're tapping into God's divinity, and mm-hmm. you're prophesying, you're speaking the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
Prayer is not that at all.
Why?
At most, it's what the Rav calls an encounter between man and God. You stand there in silence, encountering God. There is no true dialogue as we know it as man to man. It's the dialogue of man to God, where you stand in silence and you know Dalifne Miata Omed. It's the intellectual awareness that there's a supreme being. You're not speaking or transmitting the divinity and word of God to anyone.
Nothing's coming back to us. In prophecy, doesn't stuff come back to you? In prophecy,
but that's what the Rav means, that they're related to the order in which it's conducted. But I'm not sure what you're saying. I'm not sure what you're asking.
In other words,
I don't say, what do you what?
Look what, at it in a linear sense.
You're talking to God.
No, you're not talking. We just spent a couple of weeks saying that there's no talk. It's only
Jay. Reb Chaim Brisker would never say that you could just stand and be aware that you're in God's presence. Reb Chaim's Holvart is that when you're talking to God in prayer, you have to know that you're in God's presence. But we're not negating the fact that we mezukt verter. We say words. We say a hell of a lot of words. We say words.
So, and that's even so,
agreed. But the fact is that we do say words.
No,
we do.
So the linear progression of that is the exact opposite of prophecy.
Why? Oh, you're right. It's the opposite of prophecy. That the Rav is going to say the opposite order in which it is conducted. Prophecy, God speaks to us. Prayer, we speak to Him.
Okay.
That's what the Rav is about to say.
So how can one be a supersession or a continuation?
It's not a supersession, it's a continuation.
Even that is something entirely different.
Why? A dialogue means one is speaking to the other. Remember, we spoke about, again, in an encounter, there's an encounter that doesn't have to do with words, and then there's the dialogue that is an expressed, communicated part of the encounter. Let's remember, there's three different things. There's... What's the line in Simon and Garfunkel? People talking without listening, right?
Right.
Okay, so there's people talking without listening. That's dialogue without encounter. Then on the other spectrum, there's encounter without dialogue. That's two people staring at each other in the eyes and saying a lot more than could ever be said with words. Prayer and prophecy are the in-between. Meaning, what you're supposed to have is encounter and dialogue. If you have a deep relationship with somebody, that Adam 2, Eve 2 type relationship, but two deep friends, then you look at each other in the eye and you communicate in the deepest way, and you could say words. But the words are a continuation of the encounter. So the Rav is saying that prayer and prophecy are two sides of the same coin, because there's the encounter of man and God, and the only difference between prayer and prophecy is who's doing the talking. The encounter is always man and God. That's why prayer is a continuation, it's a perpetuation of the prophetic community. The only difference, what the Rav is about to say, is the direction, the order which is conducted. Who's doing the talking? Let's read the next sentence. While within the prophetic community, God takes the initiative, He speaks and man listens. In the prayer community, the initiative belongs to man. He does the speaking and God the listening. So in both prophecy and prayer, it's not like Simon and Garfunkel said, it's not people talking without listening. It's both people talking and listening. It's encounter with dialogue. But when the word of prophecy is God's and is accepted by man, the word of prayer is man's and God accepts it. That's the var. That's why it's linear. That's why it's two sides of the same coin. The two halachic traditions. Yeah, we're clear?
We really hadn't. I mean, we had no choice, all right? Because the Shechina died out at that point in time.
The Shechina didn't.
Well, but
I wouldn't use that choice of words, but semantics matter in theology. The Shechina became not apparent to us, yes.
Right, so it wasn't, the Shechina wasn't apparent to us anymore.
Right.
So if we wanted to continue having a relationship with God, then we had to say that we had to have prayer.
That's right. But that's the beauty of what the Rav is saying. And that's my favorite sentence is Mamish coming up very soon. What the Rav is saying is that, well, I don't want to say, you know, Reuven, hold that thought. You'll see how the Rav says it. Yeah?
With prophecy.
Yeah.
And with prayer, when there was prophecy. You had both. You had a dialogue going back and forth. Right? You had people praying to God, and also God, in certain respects, answering them. Those prayers directly, meaning talking back to people.
Right.
Now you have only a one-way street, which we think, we'd like to believe, God hears. But in prophecy, there was absolute concrete, again, everything is up in your head, but we believed God was talking to us and that we were talking to Him, and there was a dialogue. Now we don't really know. I mean,
can I tell you something?
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that people responded to God, prophets responded, wasn't a real response, a real human response. You know, Eliezer Berkowitz, you know, Reuven and I are big fans, Berkowitz writes, you know, very often that when prophecy overcame prophets, they didn't really, even though God made space for them, quote unquote, they didn't really elect to be able to express themselves in a really humanistic way because they were so overwhelmed by God. Even though, in fact, the only prophet, remember that we just read last week, this past Shabbos, We know Moses was the greatest of prophets. In what way does the Torah, it's in Chumash, it's not a Chassidus Sefer, it's a Chumash. In the Torah, when it wants to explain Moses' prophecy, what words does it use?
Panam upon him,
and what are the next words? Even more important, face to face, but then it uses more words. That's even more meaningful than face to face. Remember, right after face to face? Ki daber ish el re'ehu. As a man speaks to his friend. Mm-hmm. Meaning that Moshe, like really spoke to God, like a man speaks to his friend. It was, I don't want to say a conversation of equals, but it was like, the other prophets, when they responded, like if you read, you know, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, you read these other prophets, when they respond to God, it's like, Hayalikim, you know, like, oh my God, it's like, it's almost like ecstatic adoration. It's not like a conversation. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is true, that man did speak back, but it wasn't really man as man. Because only by Moses or when Mashiach comes, will there be true equality and conversation with God as an equal. Between Moses and Mashiach, there's either God mainly doing the talking, and those prophets like meekly sort of responding. And our job is that we are actually talking to God as men, as humans. We really do speak with our full faculties. That's the beauty of prayer. It's almost like that's what we gain from God not being a parent. It's that we are able to really communicate as we really are as human beings. We're not overwhelmed.
But Lahavdil, and I don't think this is the wrong way, which it could be, it's no different than a man talking to his idol. From a totally logical, objective standpoint, meaning we're talking to God. We believe that we're talking to God, and we believe that God is listening. And I personally believe that God answers us.
Which is what I was about to say, that God also does.
He does answer us.
Yeah.
It could also, though, be not. But the action of prayer today, where you pray and there's no lights going on, it's no different than a guy standing and talking to a cross. Again,
Lenny, so let's put this in perspective. There's the content of what's being said and the address to whom it's being said. You're right now saying, I think what you're saying is, I have no quote-unquote certainty in the address to whom I'm directing it, then the Christian or whatever, the guy talking to an idol, right? So I agree with you that the addressee is God is a matter of faith.
It all comes down
100%. All comes down, because, right, because there's a lot in Judaism. We could explain rationally the idea of God, that God listens to prayer is irrational. Mm-hmm. Illogical, that's faith, 100%. But what I'm not talking about here is not the address, the addressee. I'm talking about the content of what's being said, the way that we're talking. That's what we're focusing on here. The way that we talk to God now, again, it's faith that it's God that's being addressed. But look at the way that we talk to God now. When you speak to God now, it's a lot more mosaic. It's a lot more that, like, you talk to a friend than when Isaiah and Ezekiel responded to God. That's the point that I'm making.
Okay.
When you talk to God now, it's you playing with all your marbles. It's you playing with a full deck. It's you as a human being. Mm-hmm. Right? That's why, like, Reb Nachman of Breslov, I personally don't relate to this type of thing at all. But you ever heard of his Bodidus?
Yeah.
Breslov? Mm-hmm. I personally like it. I don't know. I don't. It's not my cup of tea. But Reb Nachman's point of his Bodidus is just to chat with God. Like, just shoot the breeze.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. What's the point? Now, so, whether you subscribe to this Boidus or not, but the point Reb Nachman is saying is that the focal thing of prayer is that God is supposed to be your friend, and you're talking to him as a complete human being. Mm-hmm. That the prophets didn't have. That's what the Rav is saying. The prophets didn't have that. You're right that Jeremiah might have responded to God, but it wasn't him as a human being. It was him being overcome by the glory. We speak to God, really, we speak to him, we encounter him. Mm-hmm. If you come to God in an authentic way, in Yiddish, mezak tuchasaf and tish, right? You know, like everything on the table, you talk to God with your authentic way, you're talking as a real human being. And therefore, It's really, that's what the Rav is saying, that it's a real, that we have the opportunity to perpetuate the dialogue because prayer affords us the possibility to really express to God what we're really feeling.
Except, and I accept everything you said, that's correct. The only difference is that the prayers that we use today don't really lend themselves to being convert. It's as far away from a conversation as you can kind of get.
So only because it's, right, again, because it's institutionalized. So first of all, remember, always important to remember that the, number one, there are places in the prayer service that you're supposed to put in your own words, whether by Shema Tefillah, right, mm-hmm, or by the end by Elihu L'Ratzon, by L'Kayin Tzor. Second of all, don't forget that, I should have said this earlier, and the Rav also means this also, prayer is not limited to the sitter. Whether his Boidudus is like a completely different thing, but you're allowed to talk to God during the day. Mm-hmm. Prayer means whenever we speak to God, that's a prayer thing. When you say to God, you could talk to God, and more than that, I always say, and I should mention this, and it's good that you're bringing it up. The Rav is going to mention very soon. Oh, he's going to mention. You know what? Let's wait to the footnote because what I was about to say is in the footnote right here. Look,
it's interesting that, yeah, Moshe with Korah says they had a vow that everyone would be
Nevi'im. Be prophets. Moshe says, everyone would be prophets, right? Let's read further. Look, the two halachic traditions tracing the origin of prayer to Abraham and the other patriarchs, that's one opinion in the Gemara Brachos, meaning that they instituted it, and attributing the authorship of statutory prayer to the men of the great assembly. As the Rav is speaking about, what's the machlekes? Who instituted prayer? The patriarchs or the men of the great assembly? In other words, what's another way that we've been saying this until now? Is prayer biblical Judaism from patriarchs or rabbinic? Mm-hmm. So the Rav says that's actually two halakhic traditions, right?
Rambam and Ramban.
Oh, that's what he's going to say in the footnote in a second. One second. Reveal the Judaic view of the sameness of the prophecy and prayer communities. In other words, that there's an opinion that it comes from the patriarchs, and that there's an opinion that it comes from the Many Great Assembly, shows you that it's two sides of the same coin. That essentially, like you've been saying, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob heard God speak back. Mm-hmm. But yet there's another opinion that is Anshek Nasagdola, but the two opinions are not arguing. They're saying that it's a dialogue that's continuing in different ways. Mm-hmm. It's just a different direction. The question is, who's doing the main talking? By the prophets, by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God was the main talking, and they just responded. And by prayer, we do the main talking, and God responds. Sometimes in ways that we'd prefer a little more loud, but he always responds. Now look at the footnote, and this is what I was going to say to you before, about remembering that prayer is not just in the sitter. Everyone sees the footnote? See Brachos 26 and Megillah. It is not my intention here to investigate the controversy between Maimonides and Nachmanides as to whether the precept of prayer is Pentateuchic or Rabbinic origin, right? What's the Machlekes Rambam or Ramban? All agree that the statutory standardized prayer was introduced by the Men of Great Assembly. So this is what I was about to say to you, Lenny. There's a Machlekes Rambam and Ramban. The Rambam holds that prayer every day, praying every day is a mitzvah esei derais, it's one of the 613. The Rambam holds davening every day is Pentateuchical. I don't know how to pronounce that. Pentateuchic. Right? It comes from the Torah. It's Midaraisa. Huh?
Biblical.
Right? The Rambam says Deraisa.
Pronounce that word biblical.
Yeah, right. What does the Ramban hold? Who remembers what the Ramban holds?
Rabbinic. I can't quote where it is,
rabbinic? Huh? So that's Deraisa. Wait, what does the Ramban say is rabbinic?
Carbonos.
No. Wait. What does the rabbinic say? What's the machlekes Rambam? The Rambam says davening every day is deraisa, min haTorah. The Ramban says davening every day is rabbinic. That's the machlekes. The Rambam says davening every day is from the Torah. The Ramban says davening every day is rabbinic. That's the machlekes. Okay? For the footnote, then I'll get back to what I was going to say. So that's the machlekes. The Rambam says davening of day is deraisa. The Ramban says it's rabbinic. Okay, but the Rav is saying in the footnote that the Rambam does agree that the statutory standardized prayer, the institutionalization, that of course is rabbinic. Okay, mm-hmm. So the Rav is saying that machlekes has nothing to do with what the Rav is saying. In other words, the Rebbe is saying, what I'm telling you, that prayer, institutionalized prayer, is a continuation of prophecy, is according to the Rambam and the Ramban. Because the fact is that the patriarchal prayer and the men of the Great Assembly prayer is a continuation. It's the same thing. It's just who's doing the main talking. So it has nothing to do with the Machlekes, the Rambam and the Ramban, right? But what I wanted to say to you before is what Reuven just said now. So again, the Rambam says davening every day is from the Torah, the Ramban says from the rabbis. But the Ramban that says davening every day is from the rabbis agrees that there is some prayer that's deraisa. What's that? When would the Ramban say that prayer is from the Torah?
Eis tzara.
In simple English, well, time of distress, but in real simple English is when you need something. And that is so important to remember. The Rambam says davening every day is from the Torah. The Ramban says derabanan. But if you need something, everyone would agree you have a mitzvah from the Torah, like shofar and matzah, to speak to God in your own words. So that's what I was going to respond to you. The Rav is not saying prayer only means, of course, institutionalized prayer, the Rav wants to say that's a perpetuation. But it's not limited to that. If you need something, if in the course of the day, it's so important, in the course of the day, you're trying to catch a bus. You're in a traffic jam and you need to get somewhere. And you lift up your eyes and you say, God, please help me. I really need your help here. You've done a mitzvah deraisa. People don't chop it because, like, you don't put on your garta. Well, I don't know if you don't wear a garta, but people don't chop it because, like, you're not running to shul. You don't, like, have the whole, you know, ceremony of it. But that's what speaking to God. When you need something and talking to God, you know, blowing on the dice and say, Grandma needs a new pair of shoes, right? That's a mitzvah sase derayah. Well, I don't know if, you know, if you're winning, blowing on the dice, but you get what I'm saying, right? That's when everyone would agree you have a mitzvah from the Torah to speak to God. So what the Rav is saying is that what I was saying before, that speaking to God as a human being and not a prophet that's been overcome by the glory, that's something that we're perpetuating, that encounter, that dialogue.
And everyone always needs something. So then it would seem like there's always a mitzvah to rise of the... I mean, if you don't need, you know, if you don't need a new pair of shoes, Grandma needs a new pair of shoes. And if she doesn't need a new pair of shoes, someone needs a pair of shoes.
And a chanami, you're right.
So
100%.
This idea, so you're basically saying it's always, every day it's a mitzvah to rise.
Well, the question is, if you feel like you're in, the actual wording, as the Ramban says, as Reuven said, is eis tzara, a time of distress. So a lot of people that are like, you know, there's a lot of people are chilled out, they're fine, they're like, okay. You know, there's a parable that Hasidim said, that like, what not to be, right? They say that this is how not to be a religious person. That there was once a very wealthy guy, you know, the Gvir von Stott, you know, the wealthy guy of the town. And, you know, he had a wife, he had kids, everything was fine. You know, he had enough money. And he would come to shul every Erev Yom Kippur. Once a year would come to shul. And he would open up the Aron Kodesh, stick his head in and say, Master of the Universe, it's been a good year. You haven't bothered me. I haven't bothered you. Let's keep it like that. See you next year. So...
It works for me.
So there are people like that. There are people like, I'm from, you know, there are a lot of I'm from, I'm davening, everything's okay. You know, the hedge funds are doing well. Everything's good. Again, because as from Jews, we're so used to the going to shul experience of Shabbos morning with the candy bags and like talking to the friend. Like sometimes it's just a cultural thing. I don't need to tell you, right? The shaila is when you daven to God, is like, I feel like I need something and I'm in a time of stress, of distress, and I talk to God and say, Master Universe, help me. So you're right that really we could feel that. You know the famous story of Rav Amnuna Saba, the Zohar says, Rav Amnuna Saba used to daven to God for food after he sat by the table and the table was set. I'll tell you a beautiful... Now, because of this question, you just reminded me of a beautiful idea. Shavuos is coming up not too far away. And I want to say it over because it's such a beautiful idea. It's a great idea. It's one of the things that, like, you know, it's a light bulb type of thing. So, Shavuos, we read the book of Ruth, right? Right? Shavuos, we read the Megillus Ruth. Why do we read Ruth and Shavuos?
The Omer, huh?
Huh? One of the reasons is the Omer. Because we converted is another reason that's given. What are other reasons?
Amoni and Malavi.
What does it have to do with Shavuos?
That
that's a rabbinic, right?
That the Shavuos is when we got the rabbinic laws, and they're the ones that changed the oral laws, allowed the Amun, is good. That's another reason given. Anyone know another reason? The most famous one nobody said, because Shavuos is David HaMelech's Yahrzeit, and Ruth was his grandmother, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lots of reasons. But those are reasons people usually give. Almost nobody knows the Magen Avraham. It's fascinating. Whenever I've taught this idea many times, I've never heard anyone say the Magen Avraham. Probably because it's so depressing. The Magen Avraham in Shulchan Aruch says, you know why we read Rus and Shavuos? Because to teach you that just like Rus only acquired God through poverty and suffering, to acquire Torah you need poverty and suffering. I don't remember the exact wording. You need poverty and suffering to get Torah. So that's what we read on Shavuos, because just like Rus had poverty and suffering, so Shavuos is acquiring Torah, so we need poverty and suffering. I mean, that talk about Musa, right? That doesn't sound very... You're right, exactly. Exactly. That's why it hasn't quoted. They don't put that one in the brochures, right? On Chabad.org or H.com, you don't have that reason. You know, that's not one of the ones listed, right? What do you mean? You can't acquire Torah unless you're poor and you're suffering? So Lubavitcher explained like this. So once the Rebbe said in the Sicha, and it mamish lit for exactly what you're asking over here. The Rebbe said like this. He brought the Rav Hamnuna Saba. That the Zohar says that Rav Hamnuna Saba would pray for food when his table was set and the food was on the table already. What's pshat? Why would you need to pray for food? If the table's in front of you, there's already a steak on the... You're sitting in La Marais and they already put a beautiful $70 steak in front of you. Why would you need to pray for food?
He was praying
for
it doesn't say he thanked. Tzoli, he prayed
for...
It says like this. He felt that all of reality is on a life support system from God now. You have $1 million in your bank. You're still poor because every moment God is renewing creation. Right now, he felt that right now, the food is right in front of you. If God is not bringing it to you, continue to bring his light and manifesting it as now, you won't have it a second later. He came to such a feeling of essential dependence on God. You know, by human beings today, it's very fashionable to say, don't be so needy. Right? Neediness is like a bad thing. You know, what do they call it from, what's that term? From when Harry met Sally, not that line. I'm talking about when in relationships, when they say being needy, what's that called? High maintenance, right? You're not supposed to be high maintenance. You're not supposed to be needy, right? You're supposed to give the other person their space. God wants us to be needy. He wants us to be high maintenance. He wants us to feel that every bite is from God right now. He's manifesting his light right now. And the Rebbe says, Rav Hamnuna Saba had food on his table and he felt poor. And he was suffering. He felt that he needs God right now. Remember the beautiful Berlin song, Every Breath You Take? Right now, every breath you take is coming from God right now.
I'd rather do it the other way. Be thankful for every breath you have and every piece of food.
Thankful, appreciate. Lenny, thanking, and that's the thing. Remember, we spoke about thanking and asking are not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. Thanking is for what happened a second ago, but we're talking about what's going to happen a second from now. You could thank God for $1 million. There were a lot of people in 2007 that were very comfortable. And they thanked God for millions of dollars. And then a minute later, it was all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And people jumped out the window all the time the stock market crashes, right? Because it could all be gone. And not just that, you don't have to just have a world global financial crisis. What Rav Hamnuna Saba felt, he honestly believed that right now God is bringing this into reality. God is right now continuing creation every moment. And he felt that you're on a life support system from God right now.
So his worry was that
he wasn't worried. It's not that he wasn't. It's not shot that he was worried. It's not a worry. And we're not trying to make everyone into Woody Allen. You know, we're not trying to make everyone. What's the word?
Neurotic.
It's not worried. It's not paranoid. It's that right that you're davening all day. That every day reality, God is bringing everything into your life now. And therefore, the Rebbe says, really, we're poor. You know who the ultimate poor person was? Who called himself poor more than any other time in the Bible? A million times he kept calling himself poor. King David. Tehillim, how many times in Psalms does King David say, Ani ve'evyon ani? Ani ve'evyon, ani with an ayin? Ani ve'evyon, I am poor and I am a pauper. He was a king! He was a king! And he says a million times in Tehillim, I'm poor, I'm a pauper. What are you talking about? What's the answer? King David was Malchus, Kabbalistically he was Malchus. He came to that real feeling of that Leslay, Zohar says, Malchus Leslay Megarme Klum. Malchus is like the moon. The moon is shining, and the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie. That's a more. But when the moon is shining, as the moon is shining to you, what does the Zohar say about the moon? Leslay Megarme Klum. It has nothing from itself. What are you looking at? It's the light of the sun. So from Nunasab, King David, they came to a place where they felt that whatever they have now is the light of God, reflecting right now. So to answer your question, does grandma need a new pair of shoes? It could be you need a new pair of shoes. In other words, really, if you come to a place where you feel that I might have $1 million in my bank, halavai mir gezukt, you know, the Eibush is a helpful machaim, you know, a couple of thousand would already be a nice start. But anyway, you could have $1 million in the bank and still feel poor because you really honestly believe, it does not mutually exclusive to thanking. Thank you, God, for a minute ago giving me $1 million. But I feel I'm poor because in a minute from now, I don't know what's going to happen. We know what's going to happen. My therapist always loves to tell me, when I tell her all the things that I have that I'm worried about, she loves to say, you know, you have to be calm living in the unknown. Does anyone know if you walk onto the street, you're not going to be hit by a car? You're going to be worried about everything. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen in a minute from now? How many stories do we know? Bad things. How many stories do we know of people that had beautiful lives, and a minute later, everything went. We should have known from it. We're poor people. We're mamish poor people. Without God, 5 minutes from now, helping us, we're poor mamish, and that's why we're. That's what the Rebbe says. That's why we read Rusan Shavuos. You can't really acquire Torah, have a relationship with God, without feeling that you're poor. Which means that you don't know 5 minutes from now, if God doesn't help you, you're not going to know what you have. And that's what the Ramban, and you're right. So if you feel that, then the Ramban would agree that every day it's a mitzvah to daven. When you have the food on your table, to still daven to Hashem and to ask for what you need. That was parenthetical. But now we need to get to my favorite sentence. Look inside.
I don't know how this fits in, but the Rambam does say in one place that it's a mitzvah d'oraita also on Yontif to get together in the Yitael, where the pasuk is Nikrei Kodesh. And Vayikra he says that it's d'oraita, not just a rabbanon.
To daven or to get together?
I think it says Lehit Palel Likanes.
Really? Mm-hmm. He holds this one of the 613?
I don't know if he says it's 613, but on the Parsha, it says that it's...
Really?
Yes. That it's, it's on the word Mikrei Kodesh.
I didn't know that. My mamash didn't know that. You're at Mikrei Kodesh, but I always understood that meant that we call it a holy festival.
You can look it up, though.
No, I trust you. I am going to look it up. No. I am. I have to do it right now, but I'll look it up. I will look it up further. Yeah, that's fascinating. He holds that there's a special mitzvah on the Yom Tovim to congregate.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to look that up. Thank you.
Ramban.
I'm going to look into that. Thank you. Let's go further.
But I don't know how that fits in here.
Well, I don't...
It's institutionalized prayer.
So if we want to get lumdish, it doesn't fit in here. I know it's a thing, because over there, it's a din in yontiv. That's not a din in tefillah. Again, I didn't see the Ramban inside, but my part of me that I hope is brisk, I'm hoping is I have some, is that that's not a din in tefillah, that's a din in yontiv.
Okay.
It's not a din in the gavra davin, it's a din in the cheftz of yontiv. Mont demands that you get together, right? So that's, but I will look inside, I will look into it. Did I ever tell you the story, the Brisker Rav, the youngest son-in-law, is Rabbi Yankel Schiff. He's still alive in Yerushalayim, and you know, so Rabbi Yankel Schiff, when he married the Brisker Rav's youngest daughter, so the Brisker Rav contacted Rabbi Aaron Kotler and said, "Send me your best bocher." And so he sent Rabbi Yankel Schiff to Yerushalayim. This we're talking. The Brisker Rav was nifted, I think, in 1960. So he sent him to Yerushalayim. And when he came, by the time he took a boat, at that time it was a boat, by the time he got to Israel, the Bris Korava passed away. So he got to Israel and he wanted to go back. He's like, why should I date her? I only wanted to date her for her father. So he's like, why should I date her? You know, Bris Korava's nifter, you know. So, but they've convinced him, you're already here, meet her once. So he met her, and the story is that they were looking for to talk about, so what are these people going to talk about in a date? So she said that, you know, that this past Shabbos, the Shabbos before, somebody in the family accidentally did something, a chil Shabbos, accidentally. So we're looking to do, so we were talking about in the family, what can we do now to do a new hiddur in Shabbos, to make up for the fact that Mechal Shabbos, what can we do, a new hiddur, a new stringency in Shabbos? So Bianca Schiff said to her, well, maybe you should, you know, light candles a couple of minutes earlier. So she says, that's not a hiddur in Shabbos, that's a hiddur in candles. She says, that's not a hiddur in Shabbos, that's a hiddur in the midst of lighting candles. So he said, oh, I still have the father. And he married her. That's still a bit. If she could say something like that, and he married her. He ended up marrying her. Top, let's go weiter. I want to get to the sentence. Says the Rav, covenantal prophecy and prayer blossomed forth. Now everything the Rav is going to say now, we just learned, but now he's going to say it beautifully. Covenantal prophecy and prayer blossomed forth the very instant Abraham met God and became involved in a strange colloquy. In other words, when did prophecy and prayer begin? When did the colloquy, when did the relationship begin? When Abraham met God and became involved in a strange colloquy. What does he mean strange over here? It doesn't mean like the doors, you know, come out of the rain when you're strange. People come out of the rain. What does he mean strange? You're like unusual, this unusual colloquy. Now here's the sentence. This is it. This is one of my favorite sentences in the world. You ready? This is a long run-on sentence. It mamash goes to like the end of one, but this is mamash. Listen to, only the Rav Karaita sentence like this. So it began when Abram met God. That's when this coin that we've been talking about tonight began. Says the Rav. At a later date, when the mysterious men of this wondrous assembly witnessed the bright summer day of the prophetic community, full of color and sound, turning to a bleak autumnal night of dreadful silence, unilluminated by the vision of God or made homely by his voice, they refused to acquiesce in this cruel historical reality, and would not let the ancient dialogue between God and men come to an end. Isn't that beautiful?
Poetic.
So poetic. I love that. I'm going to read again. At a later date, when the mysterious men of this wondrous assembly witnessed the bright summer day of the prophetic community full of color and sound, turning to a bleak autumnal night of dreadful silence, unilluminated by the vision of God or made homely by his voice, they refused to acquiesce in this cruel historical reality and would not let the ancient dialogue between God and men come to an end. For the men of the great assembly, Anshing Nes HaGdola, they knew that with the withdrawal of the colloquy from the field of consciousness of the Judaic community, the latter would lose the intimate companionship of God and consequently its covenantal status. Notice, the men knew that if we acquiesced to this withdrawal of God's voice in our consciousness, then we no longer have that shir ashirim, panim al panim, man to friend, I and thou. We won't have the relationship with God anymore. God ain't talking anymore. God ain't speaking. It's been a while since we heard his voice. And they knew that this bright summer day is coming to an end, and they refused to acquiesce to this companionship of God. Look at this. In prayer, they found the salvation of the colloquy, which they insisted must go on forever. They found the salvation to the colloquy. If God had stopped calling man, they urged, let man call God. And so the covenantal colloquy was shifted from the level of prophecy to that of prayer.
So they saved the day.
Yeah, the men of the Great Assembly, we become institutionalized and that saved the day. Because that continues that relationship, that consciousness of a relationship with God. And at the end of the day, the bottom line, and this goes back to what we spoke about 3 weeks ago, what the Rav says, the bottom of the day, as much as sometimes we love to hate the sitter and going to shul, at the end of the day, when we walk to shul, no matter what actually happens in there, we know we're trying to continue that relationship with God. And that's so true, that we've become institutionalized means that rabbinical Judaism refused to acquiesce that bright summer day full of color and sound should turn to an autumnal night and a dreadful silence.
But isn't that the challenge? Part of the challenge today is that you're doing it, you're going in consciously aware that it's not what it's supposed to be. And it's going to do it because it makes us feel good that we're not cutting off that line.
So again, it depends what you mean by what it's supposed to be. What is it supposed to be? If you mean what I said to Lenny before, if you mean that it's supposed to be God talking, no.
No, I don't mean that. I mean that you feel.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So that knowledge, however thin it is, keeps us going. It's very difficult to explain to someone. How do you explain to someone who says, "I'd come"?
Right.
It ain't working for me.
Yeah.
So I said to myself, okay, and then we have.
You know what I say to that person? Go on another date. Give it another chance.
Right. You know what it's like.
Okay.
You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Keep going on dates.
This whole thing is
make
exactly
it. You know, in other words, it's dating. It's like the dating process, and you know, a relationship. Sometimes it takes time to build a relationship.
This sounds like a guy and a girl had a great relationship, and then she said, "I'm finished with you," and the guy kept coming, standing outside of her window
with the radio. Remember that scene with John Cusack? What movie? Remember In Your Eyes?
Uh-huh. Say Anything?
Mm-hmm. No, it was way before that. It was from the 80s. Come on. Remember talking about, you know,
yeah,
no?
Yeah, yeah.
John Cusack calling him the radio, In Your Eyes.
And he's standing outside.
Right.
Sometimes she has the window open, sometimes she has it closed.
Yeah.
He's talking to her, but she never shows her face anymore. He's just hoping that the words get in.
So again, that's what I was saying before. Again, just like in the prophetic time, the prophet answered, but meekly. Mm-hmm. It's not that God never answers now. We feel his presence sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Again,
he just answers meekly.
Right.
It's well, well, again,
maybe this is the prophetic guy, the guys who had prophecies.
Yeah,
all had to have faith in the first place to even get it.
Not necessarily. No. That wasn't real faith. Right. You know the famous anecdote. The Kutzker was told, or Mendel of Kutzk was told, that the Apterov, the Oy of Yisrael, he was able to see the Ushpizin in the sukkah.
Right, there was that. Yeah.
He actually saw the Ushpizin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He could see Avraham Yitzchak. He actually was able to. So they told the Kutzker, the Apterov actually saw the Ushpizin in the sukkah. So the Kutzker laughed and he said, "I'm greater than the Apterov, because I don't see them, but I believe that they're there."
Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to see them.
But not just he's greater, because a child that doesn't need the parent to hold its hand could walk on its own.
Mm-hmm.
When the cloud leaves the tabernacle, Jews are able to journey. In other words, that's when you become.
The parent holds the hand; the kid can't learn how to walk.
Exactly.
That today
that's right. That's what I'm referencing. So that's the idea that when you, they didn't have faith, but faith sometimes is much deeper. It's much more makes you
mm-hmm.
that it's coming from your humanity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the whole idea of Siluk HaShchina. The Shekhinah not being present, like Reuven said before, affords the opportunity of humanity to attach ourselves to God from our own volition. And that's tremendous. And that's why, in some ways, we're the ones that are going to bring Mashiach, because of the fact that it's so much based on our faith and our Bechira and our coming from within ourselves. It's a lot to think about, a lot to try to manifest in our lives.
So this idea that there were a bunch of rabbis in Iraq who were concerned that Judaism was going to be destroyed because...
Iraq? The men of the Great Assembly were in Israel.
No, but, I mean, Talmud Bavli, you know, the destruction that they had to come up with a solution to save
that was
Judaism.
Again, but that was in Israel. Men of the Great Assembly were in Israel.
All right.
This was before the Mishnah, even.
Oh,
Okay. Menachem Grossman, it was even before the Mishnah.
I'm sorry, you're right. But that they said, you know what, don't
still
worry.
Still a bunch of rabbis, but in Israel,
we're,
yeah.
We're going to mumble to each other. We're not going to light up animals
so that's
anymore.
Not
we're going to
mumble how that's not what's going on. It is say anything? I'm sorry. Okay. All right.
So
Jay has the 80s.
So it's not a plan B, though.
There's certain things useless.
It's not.
It's not
a plan
so useless
B.
If we used it as a muscle now. We right. Just elevated John Cusack.
It was one of the best 80s scenes.
Yeah, agreed.
It's a
great song.
So far as, you know, had prophecy continued, maybe we would not have had institutionalized davening.
But the point
is, B for the destruction of the base of
Correct. Correct, but I'm telling you, it's not even a plan B from the prophecy not continuing. It's making us that we take the relationship in our hands. We initiate it. We're able to make that relationship with God as opposed to the prophets that were just responding.
Right.
Tough.